Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast, this from KCRG. Well, if you like the past few days with plenty of sunshine and unseasonably warm temperatures, I think you'll like today as well, as it is much of the same story. The only difference is that the wind will be lighter as compared to yesterday. Highs today will once again be in the mid to upper 60s. A 70-degree reading across parts of the area is not out of the question today. We will see a front push through on Thursday, which will drop the temperatures as we head into the weekend. By Friday, we will see some highs in the mid to upper 40s. The 50s will return for the weekend with lots of sunshine. By Monday and Tuesday, rain chances will start to pick up with highs staying into mid to upper 40s, which is more seasonable for this time of year anyway. At this point, if you are traveling for the holidays across the nation's midsection, you will be okay. Well, that's it for the weather forecast. Let's jump right into sports now. In college men's basketball, no Bourne, no problem for you and I in home opener against Loras. Story was written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa faced little resistance building and maintaining a sizable advantage in a 90-50 beatdown of Loras College in the Panther men's basketball home opener on Tuesday night. The Panthers managed the 40-point win over the Duhawks, despite leading scorer Bowen Bourne missing the game with an injury. According to UNI head coach Ben Jacobson, Bourne injured his hip flexor in practice between Tuesday's tip-off and the Panthers' season opener a week ago. Quote, "During some defensive slides, and he got a hip flexor area," Jacobson said. "He warmed up a little bit yesterday and could still feel it. We have a day off tomorrow. That was a scheduled day off. We are hoping by Thursday he is back on the practice floor," unquote. Given the time between the injury and the matchup with the Duhawks, guard Nate Hess said UNI managed to, quote, "get a feel for playing without Bourne prior to Tuesday." Quote, "It was a little different without having Bowen today," Heiss said. "Going into the game, we just wanted to get the ball up and down quick. We wanted to make them work on defense, not always take a quick shot, but work until we got a good shot," unquote. Down their star point guard, the Panthers showed exactly what Jacobson wanted to see out of his team in response to their 83-77 overtime loss to North Texas last week. Quote, "The intent, the focus, the enthusiasm to start the game, and we had it through the whole first half. Then when we had the lead, what were we going to do in the first 5 minutes of the second half? Those were the things," Jacobson said. "I feel like the things that I was thinking about, defending them, staying between them and the basket, I thought we guarded the ball well. Then, what was the transition going to be like? Were we going to win it going both ways? And then, the block outs. I felt like we did a good job in all those areas," unquote. The Panthers got out to a quick 6-0 lead in the contest before Loras guard Miles Berry managed to convert on a three-point play. UNI followed up its opening 6-0 run with an 8-0 rally to take a 14-3 lead as Hess connected on a free throw just on another side of the first media timeout at 15 minutes, 2 seconds to play in the first half. UNI pushed its lead to 20 on a Landon Wolf triple off a Trey Campbell assist to put the Panthers on top 32-12 with 7 minutes 16 remaining before halftime. According to Jacobson, the Panthers' ability to push its lead from 10 to 20 came as a product of an increased execution defensively and transition. Quote, "Our transition defense was not very good to start the game," Jacobson said. "They had four or five really wide open shots coming at us after missed shots. After that stretch, after we hit that kind of 5-6 minute mark when the game got started, I thought defensively we did. We settled in and found guys better in transition." The Panthers wrapped up the second half with a 47-19 advantage, limiting the Duhawks to 8 field goals on 32 attempts from the field and 2 of 20 from the three-point land. However, for as good as the Panthers played on the defensive end in the first half, Jacobson said he liked what he saw out of UNI more in the second frame. Quote, "If we go back to our exhibition game against Co, we put together a really good first half, and then they came out and outscored us," Jacobson said. "Tonight was the opposite. We came out and really guarded them to start the second half. That first 5 minutes of the second half, that was my favorite part of the game," unquote. Jacobson added that the leadership of the Titan Anderson and Bourne from the bench played a vital role in the Panthers' second half defense. Up next, the Panthers head south once again for a road trip that begins on Sunday with a matchup against South Florida at 4 p.m., with coverage provided by ESPN Plus and the Panther Sports Radio Network. UNI then heads to the Bahamas for a Battle for Atlantis tournament, where the Panthers will face number 20, South Carolina, in the opening round on Wednesday, November 22nd, at 11 a.m. The game will be broadcast on ESPN and the Panther Sports Radio Network. Former UNI play-by-play broadcaster Gary Rima will return to call all three games of the road trip, as current play-by-play broadcaster J.W. Cox will remain in Cedar Falls to broadcast the UNI football team's regular season finale on Saturday. Now in college football, here are three things to know about UNI commit Tano Cornell. This is a story written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa earned the commitment of in-state defensive line prospect Tano Cornell last week. The 6'2", 294-pound offensive and defensive line prospect from Iowa City High announced his decision on his personal Instagram account, flipping his pledge from Illinois State to UNI on Thursday. The youngest of five and the only boy, Cornell said family played a role in the decision to change his commitment from the Redbirds to the Panthers. Quote, "I have a pretty big family," Cornell said, "all of them being within an hour of Cedar Falls. That is going to be awesome, because they can come and support and watch my games too." He also noted that athletics runs in the family, with his older sisters Lindsay and Maddie Cornell attending Taylor University in Indiana after standout softball careers at Vinton-Shelsburg High School between 2010 and 2016. Quote, "I have great sisters," Cornell said. "Two of them played NAIA softball at Taylor University in Indiana, so athletics has been around. It has toughened me up just a little bit around the edges," unquote. In his senior year with the Little Hawks, Cornell racked up 18.5 total tackles and 6.5 tackles for loss, including 0.5 sacks. He started his career with Independence, appearing in contests with the Mustangs in both his freshman and sophomore season, and putting up 20 tackles, 4 tackles for loss, with 0.5 sacks and a fumble recovery. Now, here are three things to know about Cornell after his commitment to UNI. Number one, Bruce Paulp, the biggest reason for his flip. Cornell described the decision to pick UNI over Illinois State as a layered decision, wanting to major in business and making academics a priority. UNI started to separate itself with a strong recommendation from a brother-in-law about the quality of the university's business program. However, according to Cornell, UNI defensive line coach Bryce Paulp ended up being the biggest reason for his commitment to UNI. Quote, both universities, Illinois State and Northern Iowa, are really, really great universities, Cornell said. Quote, I love them both to death. I built relationships with the staff members at both universities. It really came down to the stability and UNI and how the coaches have been around longer. I feel like Illinois State lacked that sort of stability in the program and the coaching staff. Quote, that is important to me. I want to have a D-line coach that is going to be there for a while and knows his stuff. Both guys, they know their stuff, but having Pop here and having him so awesome and his legacy, you could not have a greater mentor than that, unquote. Number two, wants to be the guy. A very future-thinking individual, Cornell added that he wants to focus on few key areas of his game before joining the Panthers ahead of the 2024 campaign. Quote, going into the summer and spring, it's going to be strictly development, Cornell said. I feel like my size is there, my strength is there, but understanding some things on the field and breaking down the game, making it slower, but playing it at a fast high level, is really the main focus right now, unquote. He added that he knows Pop is the right coach to help him develop as a football player. Beyond his freshman year, Cornell has his eyes on becoming a staple in the middle of UNI's defensive line. Quote, within the next 3 to 4 years, 4 to 5 years, I just want to be the guy, Cornell said. I just want to be able to make plays consistently and play consistently and really be a dominant force on the inside there. And number three, set to play defensive line. Listed as a guard on the Little Hawks official roster, Cornell said he anticipates playing defensive line in college, noting that Illinois State, UNI, and North Dakota all recruited him as a defensive line prospect. However, he did note it was not quite that settled during his recruiting process. Quote, I was close with a couple Power 5 programs, Cornell said. They kind of told me I was going to be a tweener. They did not know if I was going to play guard, or if I was going to play center, or if I was going to play nose tackle. It was kind of one of those things where it was just a little uncertain at the higher level. But I think in the FCS, I am going to play nose tackle. At nose tackle, Cornell said his biggest impact is felt in the initial get off the line of scrimmage at the snap. Quote, the initial get off and shock the offensive line, Cornell said. If you get that initial push and just being a force there, you're going to be extremely dominant and shut down the inside run. That's it for sports. Now let's look at the two stories on the front page of the Courier. Reynolds backing DeSantis doesn't faze Trump supporters. What do Trump supporters say about Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' endorsement of DeSantis? Story written by Caleb McCullough and begins with a photograph of the former President Donald Trump standing in front of a stack of round bales and between American and Iowa state flags, raising his right hand in a clenched fist. Dateline Des Moines. Donald Trump supporters in Iowa have a mix of reactions to Governor Kim Reynolds' endorsement of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in his bid for the GOP presidential nomination. Supporters of Trump, who remains the Republican presidential front-runner in Iowa, according to polling, said Reynolds' decision to endorse did not affect their support of the former president, but some said it affected their view of Reynolds, who is popular among Iowa Republicans. Explaining the reasons for her endorsement, Reynolds said in media interviews on November 6th that she did not believe Donald Trump could win the general election. She also praised DeSantis' leadership and effectiveness as an executive, promising that he would lead on conservative principles and not be distracted. Quote, Ron is focused. He is principled. He is results-driven. And, in short, what I love most about Ron is he gets things done, she said. Trump garnered 43% of the support of likely Republican caucus-goers in a recent Des Moines Register NBC News Mediacom Iowa poll. DeSantis registered 16%, tying for second place with former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The poll included South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott, who has since dropped out of the race. Paul Dykstra, a resident of Kellerton and state House candidate in 2022, said the endorsement did not change his opinions on Trump or Reynolds. Quote, "Governor Reynolds has been a good governor," he said. "She had to make a lot of tough decisions in the last 3 years. All I tell anybody who gets critical of anybody, quote, walk a mile in their shoes, and what would you do?" Unquote. Dykstra said he was confident the party leaders would be able to come back together after the primary and leave any disagreements in the past. Quote, "Nothing is really decided until the caucuses here in Iowa, and that's when we as a state got to come together and support the one that is selected," he said. But others said they were disappointed in Reynolds for endorsing an opponent of the former president. Trump criticized Reynolds in July for, at the time, remaining neutral in the caucuses and not endorsing him. He again lashed out at Reynolds on Truth Social after news broke that she would endorse DeSantis. He called the decision the, quote, end of her political career, unquote. Laura Odstamore, a farmer from Harrison County, said she thought Reynolds made the wrong decision, and it made her question her support for the governor. Quote, "Reynolds has done a few things I'm not happy with, but all in all, she seemed to be pretty good," she said. Quote, "But this kind of tipped me the other direction. I went, wow, I can't believe she just did that," unquote. She said Reynolds' endorsement of DeSantis made her more confident in her support of Trump. The same is true for Mike Vixler, a Cedar County supervisor who has thrown his support behind Trump. Vixler said he was very disappointed that Reynolds endorsed DeSantis. Repeating an argument Trump has made, Vixler said Trump helped Reynolds become governor by tapping former Governor Terry Branstad as the ambassador to China, which led to then-Lieutenant Governor Reynolds assuming the role. Quote, "I just think her loyalty should be with Donald Trump no matter what, whether she wants to come out and say it or not," Bixler said. "But especially to back DeSantis, so far back in the polls is, I think, politically suicidal," unquote. While Bixler said Reynolds will still remain a popular governor, he said he was going to, quote, "step back and take a look at his support for her." Quote, "If you look at Trump rallies and the support they're trying to keep Iowa first in the caucuses and all the money that Trump has brought in with his rallies, I'm just very surprised that she would even take a chance for or against coming out in public," he said. At the Des Moines rally where Reynolds announced her endorsement for DeSantis, he predicted she may attract some criticism, commending her for backing his candidacy. Quote, "I appreciate Governor Reynolds getting involved in the process," DeSantis said of the endorsement. Quote, "Now look, when you do that, some people don't like it, and some people say this or that. But I think that she understands what I understand, which is this country has hit the skids. This country is in a period of decline," unquote. Gary Loeffler, a member of the Polk County Central Committee and former primary candidate for Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, who supports Trump, said he spoke with Reynolds briefly a few days after she endorsed DeSantis, telling her he harbored no ill feelings for her decision. Quote, "Because you pick a different flavor of ice cream to me, you're still my governor, and you've still been a good governor," he said. "I don't have any animosity. Obviously, do I wish that she would have picked President Trump? Yeah. How will Reynolds' endorsement affect the race? As for the effects of Reynolds' endorsement on caucus campaign, the Trump supporters said they don't think it will do much in pulling away support from the former president. Quote, "I'm sure that Governor Reynolds will impact some people," Loeffler said. "The feedback I've seen is maybe 2 or 3 points at the most," unquote. Dykstra said he did not think the endorsement would have much impact on the race, saying the community-based nature of the caucuses has more of an impact than endorsements. Quote, "When people get together in their communities and have a good discussion on whom they support and why they support them, and there's any amount of reasoning that takes place, I think people come together and make a good decision, he said. Next, weather smiles on Iowa as harvest nears completion. The story begins with a photograph of a combine going through a cornfield in a farm north of Cedar Falls, and it's in a big cloud of dust. Dateline Des Moines. Warm, dry weather prevailed across a majority of Iowa, resulting in 6.7 days of suitable work for field work during the week, ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Fieldwork included harvesting corn and soybeans, completing fall tillage, applying fall fertilizer, baling stalks, and hauling manure. Quote, the unseasonably warm and dry weather this past week offered Iowa farmers another suitable stretch to finish up harvest and tackle other farm work, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg. Quote, we expect warmer temperatures to hang around this week, though forecasts show a more active storm track as we approach Thanksgiving. Corn harvested for grain reached 94% statewide, on pace with last year, but 10 days ahead of the five-year average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain remained steady at 16%. Soybean harvest is nearly complete, on pace with last year, and 9 days ahead of the average. Let's take a look at the Metro Briefs column. University of Northern Iowa to observe International Education Week. Dateline Cedar Falls. Every year, worldwide, educational institutions, businesses, communities, and organizations come together to celebrate the work done to expand internationalization, cross-cultural exchange, and increase awareness in their communities during International Education Week, which will be celebrated November 13th through the 17th on the UNI campus. The international student population at UNI during the fall semester is made up of 177 individuals from nearly 60 different countries. Quote, International Education Week is a fantastic opportunity to highlight what UNI is doing to create more diverse and globally minded individuals, recognize our international community, and share our on-campus efforts to prepare students to be global citizens, leaders, and professionals in and outside of the classroom, said Carolina Coronado Park, Director of International Engagement. International education is a catalyst for leading change and understanding worldwide issues. It is a melting pot of individuals learning and sharing global perspectives. This exposes students, faculty, and the community to different cultures, ethnic groups, religions, and languages, which in turn enriches society and broadens the academic experience for everyone. The Office of International Engagement, in collaboration with various offices, departments, and community partners, brings a week of activities, events, programs, and more to UNI and the Cedar Valley. A full schedule of events and more information about International Education Week can be found on the UNI website. Next, War is All Hell, presentation planned Thursday at Civil War Roundtable. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Civil War Roundtable on Thursday will feature a presentation by Edward Bloom. The meeting begins at 7 p.m. at Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, 3117 Green Hill Boulevard. The entrance is on the upper level. Zoom connection information will be sent to members prior to the meeting. Quote, war is all hell, unquote, peers into the world of devils, demons, Satan, and hell during the Civil War. It charts how African Americans and abolitionists compared slavery to hell, how Unionists rendered Confederate secession illegal by linking it to Satan, and how many Civil War soldiers came to understand themselves as living in hellish circumstances. Next, Veridian offers scholarships. Dateline Waterloo. Veridian Credit Union opened scholarship applications to award a total of $18,000 to 9 students for the 2024-25 academic year, an increase from the $14,000 award to 7 students last year. 4 high school seniors and 4 post-high school applicants will each receive $2,000 toward tuition for post-secondary education at an accredited vocational, undergraduate, or graduate program. An additional $2,000 will be awarded in conjunction with the credit union's Art Share program to a high school senior enrolling in an accredited program that leads to a career in the arts. Applications are due with a 500-word essay on February 2nd for all but the Art Share scholarship, which are due on April 26th. Eligibility and application details for both scholarships are available at veridiancu.org/scholarship. The Veridian Scholarship will be administered by the Iowa Credit Union Foundation. Plans pending for dozens of new Cedar Falls homes. P&Z hears plans on development north of Aldrich Elementary. Story written by Andy Malone. And the dateline is Cedar Falls. Developer Brent Dahlstrom's plans for new houses north of Bess Streeter Aldrich Elementary School were introduced for review to the Planning and Zoning Commission on Wednesday. Cedar Falls is reportedly starved for housing as its western growth continues, while the school families are desperate for an Arbors Drive extension north to Green Hill Road to help alleviate traffic and safety concerns. Kevin Fitro, manager of Dahlstrom's Panther Builders, said the company hopes to wrap up the land use process, which includes future platting of the approximately 130 single-family lots, in time to start constructing the roads next fall. Panther Builders plans to sell the lots, construct some houses on its own, and expects home construction to start the following winter or spring. It will be the first of 4 phases in developing the area. Panther Builders is asking the commission to rezone what's known as Prairie West, the northern 54.79 acres from R1 Residence District and MU Mixed Use Residential District to RP Planned Residence District. The company is also requesting to change the future land use map from neighborhood commercial and mixed use and greenways and floodplain use to low-density residential. The commission heard about the plans, scheduled a public hearing for November 21st, and heard initial concerns about stormwater runoff. Councilmember Dave Sires, a huge advocate for the new roads, was in attendance, as is often the case, at the commission's bi-monthly meeting. After that hearing, the commission could decide to approve or deny the rezoning and plan change. A plat already has been approved for the vacant area east of the school, known as Prairie Wind, and a westward extension of Ashworth Drive to the school, another important connection. An anticipated construction date for the housing is not yet known, as Panther Builders staff goes through the city's internal review process, according to Fitro. In June, the city council signed off on an agreement with Dahlstrom to split the cost for the new road connections around the school. Previously, there had been no incentive for Panther Builders to continue developing the land and immediately construct what many say are vital road connections. Prairie Wind and Prairie West are not the only big residential projects pending in western Cedar Falls. The other involves Dennis Happel's BNKD plans for the final phase of the Autumn Ridge subdivision west of Union Road near the corner of First Street. Happel is forwarding a master plan amendment to the council for consideration, likely on November 20th, after the Planning and Zoning Commission unanimously denied 86 new residences being constructed there, a significant uptick in the housing density from the original 58 proposed in 2013. If he doesn't get council approval of that and the development procedures agreement, his next steps are unknown. Happel declined comment Wednesday on his rationale for bringing the plans to the council, when he could have revised them. He was at City Hall for a minor change to plot lines for lots along Golden Lane, which is further south in the Autumn Ridge subdivision. And now, listeners, we would just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 15th, on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now this announcement.
It only took Jeff one interview to land his job, one smile to get his wife to go out with him, and one time to risk it all by trying meth. Meth. Never, ever. Visit yourlifeiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now we turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today appeared in the New York Times and was written by Jesse Wegman. We waited 200 years for this Supreme Court ethics code? On first impulse, I was tempted to say something nice about the Supreme Court's first ever ethics code, which the justices released on Monday after years of pleas from the American public and lawmakers of both parties. But the most striking thing about the code was its resentful tone. Call it the condensation of the unelected. In responding to the widespread outrage that has followed detailed news reports of repeated and egregious ethical violations, most notably by two of its most senior justices, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the court chose to gaslight the American people, upon whom it depends for its legitimacy. Quote, "The absence of a code," the court wrote in a sniffy one-paragraph opening statement, quote, "has led in recent years to the misunderstanding that the justices of this court, unlike all other jurists in the country, regard themselves as unrestricted by any ethics rules," unquote. As Justice Alito might say, not true. The only misunderstanding here, a willful one it seems, is on the part of the court. Regular Americans understand perfectly well what's going on. If they question the justices' commitment to ethical virtue, it's because of the justices' own behavior, the lack of a written code, the actual way in which they are, unlike all other judges, who have been subject to such a code for the last 50 years, is merely emblematic of the deeper problem, which is that the Supreme Court considers itself answerable to no one. Even if it were a popular misunderstanding, why wait until the public is clamoring for action? Any politician will tell you to get ahead of the scandal for precisely this reason. After the fact, it just looks like a sloppy cleanup in aisle 5. That's an insult to the hundreds of millions of us who live under the court's edicts, many of which implicate the most personal aspects of our lives. A tribunal so powerful, one that genuinely cared about protecting and nurturing its fragile authority, would voluntarily and preemptively subject itself to the highest ethical standards imaginable. Not this court. Quote, "One of the themes we've heard from Chief Justice Roberts and others is essentially this message of, just trust us. We don't need to be constrained like everybody else." Alicia Bannon, director of the Judiciary Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, told me, quote, "And I don't think their behavior has earned that trust," unquote. The sustained public uproar over that behavior, measured most clearly in the court's record low approval ratings, appears finally to have pierced the bubble at 1 First Street. In recent months, Justices Elena Kagan and Amy Coney Barrett have publicly supported the adoption of an ethics code. This rare bout of self-awareness makes the feebleness of the court's response that much more frustrating. There is an understandable desire to praise the justices for doing what so many, including the Times editorial board, have called for. But my primary reaction on seeing the result is, we waited 200 years for this? The most glaring defect of the new code is its complete lack of any enforcement power. Its 15 pages are littered with weak verbs like should, should not, and endeavor to, which, as any college student on a pre-exam bender will tell you, is a reliable way to sound serious without actually doing the work. And yet, the absence of any discipline or enforcement was the central flaw that led to calls for an ethics code in the first place. Whatever the justices do, they must know that there will be no professional repercussions. Appointed for life and removable only by impeachment, they are effectively untouchable. It doesn't matter how virtuous you think you are. In the long term, this brew of power and unaccountability can be corrupting. What's included in the code is as troubling as what's missing. On the matter of outside influences on the justices, the main reason for the current public pressure on the court, the language is almost laughably vague and permissive. Quote, a justice should not allow family, social, political, financial, or other relationships to influence official conduct or judgment, unquote. Well, sure. But what in this sentence would have stopped Justice Thomas or Justice Alito from developing their relationships with those uber-wealthy Republican donors who seem so often to come into their orbit, and who, by the way, happen to be connected to cases before the court? You can still hang out with all the people trying to influence you, this sentence seems to suggest, just as long as you claim you're not influenced by them, as the justices have often done, without any enforcement mechanism or even an impartial body to determine when a relationship, financial or otherwise, has gone too far, it becomes meaningless. Then there's the related issue of recusal, which goes to the heart of judicial integrity and has come up repeatedly in matters involving Justices Thomas and Alito. In addition to the substantial and unreported gifts they received, Justice Thomas refused until very recently to disqualify himself from cases involving the January 6th Capitol attack, even though his wife, Virginia, was deeply involved in the legal efforts to keep former President Donald Trump in office, despite his electoral defeat. The code purports to lay out a clear recusal standard, but it only muddies the waters. Quote, a justice should disqualify himself or herself in a proceeding in which the justice's impartiality might reasonably be questioned, that is, where an unbiased and reasonable person who is aware of all the relevant circumstances would doubt that the justice could fairly discharge his or her duties, unquote. Finally, if there's a close call in a recusal case, the code offers another ethical off-ramp for the justices, the duty to sit. There are only 9 of them, the reasoning goes, and they are the highest court in the land. Lower federal judges are replaceable, but Supreme Court justices are not, even if a reasonable person would have a legitimate concern about a justice's ability to be fair in a given case. Taken together, Ms. Bannon said, these provisions could have the perverse effect of reducing the ethical obligations, not only of the justices, but also of the entire federal judiciary. Quote, they've essentially taken the position that they've already been abiding by these provisions, she said. Adopting the code in that light, quote, sends the message to the entire judiciary that the Supreme Court's shoddy ethical record is the floor for everyone, unquote. The bottom line is the same as it has always been. The Supreme Court cannot police itself. Real policing would require something like an internal ethics office at the court, or perhaps an inspector general for the judiciary branch, as Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa has long proposed. Either way, a meaningful enforcement mechanism is the only path forward. Quote, if you're going to create a code that is clearly responding to current events, you have to have consequences or new structures that will prevent those events from happening again, said Gabe Roth of the advocacy group Fix the Court. I really want to be positive about this new code. At the very least, it serves as an acknowledgement that the court is aware of its delicate place within the larger society and must be responsive to widespread concerns about its integrity. Its publication creates a basic standard against which the justice's future behavior can be measured. But if the court wants to regain its standing with the American people, it's going to have to try harder than this. Walmart and Costco and other companies are rethinking self-checkout. Dateline New York. The backlash against self-checkout is growing, and stores are starting to dial back on the technology after it exploded over the past few years. Booths, a British supermarket chain, said it's removing self-checkout stations in all but two of its 28 stores. In the United States, Walmart, Costco, Wegmans, and other chains have also revised their self-checkout strategies. Quote, our customers have told us this over time, that the self-scan machines that we've got in our stores can be slow, they can be unreliable, and they're obviously impersonal, Booth's managing director Nigel Murray told the BBC. Customers at Booth's also frequently misidentified which fruits and vegetables they were buying when prompted by self-checkout machines. Alcohol purchases were also not smooth transactions through self-checkout because employees had to verify customers' ages. Quote, some customers don't know one different apple versus another, for example, Murray said. There's all sorts of fussing about with that, and then the minute you put any alcohol in your basket, somebody's got to come and check that you're of the right age. A spokesperson for Booth's told CNN that employees checking out shoppers was a better customer experience. Self-checkout machines were first introduced during the 1980s to lower labor expenses. They shifted the work of paid employees to unpaid customers. Self-checkout expanded at supermarkets in the early 2000s. As stores looked to cut costs and during the pandemic, many shoppers used self-checkout for the first time to minimize close interaction with employees and other customers. But now, retailers are rethinking self-checkout. They have found that self-checkout leads to higher merchandise losses from customer errors and intentional shoplifting, known as shrink, than human cashiers ringing up customers. Shrink has been a growing problem for retailers who have blamed shoplifting for the increase and called for tougher penalties. But retailers' self-checkout strategies have also contributed to their shrink problems. One study of retailers in the United States, Britain, and other European countries found that companies with self-checkout lanes and apps had a loss rate of about 4%, more than double the industry average. Some products have multiple barcodes or barcodes that don't scan properly with self-checkout technology. Produce, including fruit and meat, typically needs to be weighed and manually entered into the system using a code. Customers may type in the wrong code by accident. Other times, shoppers won't hear the beep confirming an item has been scanned properly. Other customers take advantage of the lax oversight at self-checkout aisles and have developed techniques for stealing. Common tactics include not scanning an item, swiping a cheaper item, bananas, for a more expensive one, steak, scanning counterfeit barcodes attached to their wrists, or properly scanning everything and then walking out without paying. Stores have tried to limit losses by tightening self-checkout security features, such as adding weight sensors. But additional anti-theft measures also lead to more frustrating, unexpected item in the bagging area errors, requiring employees to intervene. Walmart removed self-checkout machines at some stores in New Mexico earlier this year. ShopRite pulled them at a Delaware store after customer complaints. Wegmans last year ended a mobile app that allowed customers to scan, bag, and pay for groceries while they shopped after reporting losses. Costco said it's adding more staff in self-checkout areas after it found that non-members were sneaking in to use membership cards that didn't belong to them at self-checkout. Costco management said this year that shrink increased in part because we believe due to the rollout of self-checkout. Five Below, the discount toy retailer, said that shrink at stores with more self-checkout lanes was higher. The company plans to increase the number of staffed cash registers in new locations. Waterloo woman indicted on federal meth possession and distribution charges. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo woman has been charged in connection with the sale of large amounts of methamphetamine. A federal grand jury on Wednesday filed an indictment charging Victoria K. Osterreich with one count of conspiracy to distribute meth and two counts of possession of meth with intent to distribute. Osterreich is currently at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville, serving time on a previous drug offense, according to court records. The new charges allege Osterreich and others were involved in the distribution of at least 500 grams of a substance containing meth between October 2022 and January of 2023. She is also accused of possessing meth with intent to distribute on January 4th and January 10th, 2023. The government is seeking forfeiture of $2,000 in cash seized from her on January 4th, $900 in cash seized from her car on January 20th, and $11,800 in cash seized from her on January 10th. Osterreich has prior drug convictions in 2019 and 2020, according to court records. Man, 23, leads Cedar Falls police on chase and crashes into parked cars. Story filed by Donald Promnitz. Dateline Cedar Falls. Police have arrested a man after he reportedly led them on a chase that ended in a crash on Sunday. At 1:49 a.m., officers observed a black Dodge Challenger driving at a high rate of speed, passing a vehicle and running a stop sign in the 100 block of West 4th Street. The driver turned south on Washington Street. Police say the vehicle continued at a high rate of speed and turned off his headlights. The driver, later identified as 23-year-old Jordan Ford, then reportedly ran a stop sign at 12th and Washington Streets and struck two parked cars, disabling his car and causing significant damage to the parked vehicles. Officers made contact with the driver, and he was taken into custody. Ford and a passenger were both transported to local hospitals for evaluation. The injuries are believed to be non-life-threatening. Ford is facing multiple charges in regards to this incident. The investigation is ongoing. Cedar Falls Fire Rescue, Mercy One, and Rasmussen Towing assisted at the scene. Cedar Falls Board approves $2.7 million in furniture for the new high school. Story was written by Angela Sturm McLaughlin. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Board of Education approved $2.6 million in furniture purchases Monday for the new high school, which is on track to open next fall. Quote, "It's a $3 million estimated budget. We're excited to say that it did come in under budget," said Danielle Gonerman, Cedar Falls Community Schools Chief Financial Officer. Quote, "Just like the high school construction project, we had multiple bidders, but also multiple bids, bid packages. You'll see in the actual documentation, we had 20 bid packages. Packages were chosen that included four local bidders. Those companies and the purchase amounts were Kirk Gross Company of Waterloo for $1.17 million, Office Concepts of Cedar Falls for $317,100, Premier F&E of Waverly at $117,067, and Workspace of Cedar Falls at $1.07 million. Installation of furnishings at the high school is planned by late spring or early summer. Kendra Christensen, an interior designer with Project Consultant Envision Architecture of Waterloo, did not believe that supply chain issues would be a factor in the delivery of the furniture. Quote, "Thanks for putting together those 20 bid packages, for sending them out," said board member Lowell Stutzman. Quote, "I think in the long run, that brought our overall cost way down, so it was very clever," unquote. Quote, "It was a lot of work, and Kendra put a ton of time into this," said Superintendent Andy Petty. "It's been a 3.5-year process, and our staff and our furniture group, they went out to different conferences, different buildings. They tested a lot of different furniture, and it was really well done," unquote. Constructions on the 305,000-square-foot school located at 2701 West 27th Street has been ongoing since the initial groundbreaking in 2021. It sits on 69.6 acres within view of the Unidome to the east. Maynard Mann dies in single-vehicle pickup truck crash, and a passenger is hospitalized. The story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline is Maynard. A Maynard man died in a single-vehicle crash last week. According to the Fayette County Sheriff's Office, Cooper J. Ingalls, 21, was headed north in the area of 45th Street and R. Avenue around 1:05 a.m. on Friday when he apparently lost control of his Ford F-250 Super Duty pickup truck. Ingalls died at Old Wine Mercy Hospital, according to the sheriff's office. Michaels, 23, of Maynard, was also transported to Old Wine Mercy with serious injuries and then flown to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics in Iowa City. The Fayette County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Old Wine Police Department, Old Wine Fire Department, Fayette County Medical Examiner, and Mercy One Ambulance. The accident remains under investigation by Fayette County Sheriff's Office Technical Investigation Team. Fire closes Burger King. Dateline Waterloo. A fire has likely taken a local Burger King out of commission for several days, Waterloo Fire Rescue says. According to Battalion Chief Kevin Lee, firefighters were dispatched at 8:39 a.m. to the restaurant located at 1215 Ansborough Avenue. A fire was found in the ventilation hood above the broilers in the kitchen. Lee said the fire was put out quickly as it was contained to one area, but there was moderate smoke damage throughout the building. Lee said the restaurant would probably be closed for some time. Next, teen faces sex abuse charge. Dateline Cedar Falls. Bond has been set at $50,000 for a teen accused of sexually abusing a Cedar Falls boy for about a year. The 16-year-old Waterloo teen was charged with second-degree sexual abuse and detained on Wednesday. The incidents allegedly happened at a Cedar Falls home, and police were notified of the allegations from the Iowa Department of Human Services officials in August. The victim was interviewed by staff at the Child Protection Center, staff in Waterloo, according to police. Next, arrest made when guns found in trunk. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested in connection with a load of guns found in the trunk of his car in October. Black Hawk County Sheriff's deputies arrested 34-year-old Ian John Duffy of 3417 Governor Circle for one count of domestic abuser in possession of a firearm on Monday. He was released pending trial. According to court records, deputies stopped Duffy on Sovia Drive to serve a committal order on October 31st. In his trunk, they found a 5.56 millimeter Springfield rifle, a 12-gauge Mossberg 590 shotgun, a 40 caliber Glock 22 pistol, a 9 millimeter EAA Gerson pistol, and a 45 caliber Tissot 1911 handgun. Deputies said Duffy is prohibited from possessing firearms because of a 2009 misdemeanor domestic abuse conviction. The Cedar Falls Human Rights Commission will host an inaugural fall summit. Story filed by Andy Malone. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Human Rights Commission is organizing its largest event in years to discuss what is being done and still needs to be accomplished to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion in the community. The inaugural Fall Summit is scheduled from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Friday at Central Rivers Area Education Agency, that's located at 1521 Technology Parkway. The theme is Critical Conversations. Does that really happen here? Registration and breakfast begin at 8 a.m. One breakout session goes from 9 to 10:15 a.m. with Kyle Christensen, a family practice physician, and Mark Howard, Cedar Falls Police Chief. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.